Welcome to the Accenture MIT podcast series. Here's Daniel Jackson, professor of computer science at MIT.
In around 1993, when I was a new professor at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, I attended a talk about Gopher, a protocol that connected up files at different sites. Unlike FTP, which we were using at the time for downloading software and for obtaining articles from other researchers, Gopher could connect different sites so that you could hop from one site to another. The presenter claimed that one day, many servers would be connected together and there'd be a massive distributed repository of files to navigate. Some people were quite excited about this, and others, including me, thought it was a big fuss about nothing. How wrong we were. A few years later, Tim Berners-Lee came up with the idea of the World Wide Web, and now here we are in a world in which an organization without a website might as well not exist. To be fair, though, the web had a crucial idea that Gopher lacked. In Gopher, documents had a fixed format, and you navigated from one server to another through special menus. The key insight that Berners-Lee had was to allow the text to be completely free-form, with embedded links from one file to another, whether that file was on the same server or a different one. The idea of linked documents was an old one. Apple's HyperCard, released in 1987, was a kind of database application creator program whose data model was stacks of cards with links between them. There were other database applications that used links, but HyperCard was the most popular. It was a huge hit, in fact. But what HyperCard didn't do was allow you to link cards that were on different computers, and that was Tim Berners-Lee's big idea. Linked text is a wonderful thing. It's good for the user because it lets you navigate around in any pattern you like, exploring down some avenue and backtracking when you want to take a different path. It's good for developers because linked text can grow organically without the need for centralized management. Links have become not only signposts, but also citations. The standard way to give credit to someone else nowadays is to provide a link to their website or to their paper, blog posting, or podcast, or whatever. Let's think for a moment about the term hypertext. The idea has become so common that most of us interpret it in its narrow technical sense. Hypertext is just text that's linked together, like HTML, with links from one document to another embedded in the text. But behind the prefix hyper, which is Greek, by the way, for over or beyond, there's an implication that hypertext is really something grander than plain old written text. That where an old text is just a linear string of characters, organized by the author into a hierarchy of paragraphs, sections, and chapters, hypertext is a more dynamic thing, a collection of text fragments barely held together by a mass of links, allowing infinite paths, infinite ways to read the text. When the web was in its infancy, this idea was tremendously appealing, and many people thought that the new hypermedia would provide a new and more powerful learning experience. We wouldn't be fettered any longer by how the author thought we should read the text. We would forge our own path and augment our reading with forays off into fascinating digressions, accumulating more and more knowledge and insight as we danced around the graph of links. Only 10 years on, this idea looks a bit quaint. Hypertext has, in many settings, been replaced by artifacts with a more polished appearance, in PDF or Flash, for example. Electronic books aren't bristling with links, and the websites that publish organized material are often very hierarchical in structure. Take a look at any newspaper, for example. But surfing the web is still primarily an experience of jumping from one place to another along links, and following a link is often what leads us to something new and interesting. The deeper question is not whether hypertext is useful, it obviously is. Rather, the question is what hypertext does to our brains. Do we learn a text more rapidly and more deeply if we can navigate it as we please, picking our own path? Does having lots of opportunities to explore side issues enrich our experience and make us more able to draw comparisons and to appreciate different viewpoints? And here's the big question. Does surfing the web make us better thinkers, more agile, and more open-minded? According to Nicholas Carr, the author of the book The Shallows, which I talked about in my previous podcasts, the answer is, you won't be surprised to hear, a resounding no. On the contrary, it seems that people who read plain old linear text learn more and understand more and remember more than people who read text that's bristling with links. Carr describes a series of experiments performed by different researchers in which a text was presented in two forms, one as linear text and one as hypertext, and subjects were tested on their comprehension. They found that the hypertext produced less understanding, and subjects were left with the impression that the text didn't hold together, even when the underlying text was the same. In one particularly remarkable study, readers read the same page, but with different numbers of links, and were then given a multiple-choice test. A direct correlation between links and understanding was found. The more links, the less they understood. Carr didn't just cherry-pick these studies. In 2005, some psychologists at Carleton University in Canada did a review of 38 experiments, and although not all of them showed that links reduced understanding, they came to the conclusion that there was, quote, very little support for the theory that, quote, hypertext will lead to enriched experience of the text. On the contrary, they said, quote, increased demands of decision-making and visual processing in hypertext impaired reading performance. In other words, following links is hard work. It may be fun, and it's surely useful when you're trying to track down a quote online or plan a vacation. But if you're trying to learn something that involves reading a text, it seems that the effort of deciding which links to follow and of keeping track of where you are takes away from the effort you could be putting into understanding the text itself. Worse, it seems to be a constant distraction. Just when you're about to really grasp something or formulate a new idea, a link appears to draw your attention away, to abruptly end the topic you were following and start something completely new. Links, in other words, are distractions. Whereas reading a book curled up in a chair can be a contemplative experience like basking in the sun in a boat on a lake, reading the web is more often jerky and tiring, like driving in a bumper car in a fairground. And it's not just links that distract us, of course. The whole technology of the desktop, come check your email, read the updates on your social network, see how the stock market is doing, read the latest newspaper headlines, check out the sale in your favorite online store. These frequent interactions make us tense and anxious, and they fill our brains not with important stuff, but with lots of trivial nonsense. It's the old problem that the urgent always seems to take precedence over the important, and there's nothing more urgent than the web. The irony is that more information is available to us than ever before, but we have no time to make use of it and no time to really reflect on it. So rather than being the powerful intellectual tools we'd hope they'd be, computers are instead a technology of distraction that's making it harder for us to think, to understand, to reflect. And in the process, they're making us less relaxed and more anxious. It's ironic that what seemed to make computers exciting and stimulating may actually be the reason they're also damaging us. Not only do computers suck up vast amounts of our effort and attention in small things, it seems that they also might rob us of the relaxation that we need. Just yesterday, the New York Times ran an article entitled Growing Up Digital, Wired for Distraction, about kids who spend all their time playing video games and are failing academically. The most intriguing part of the article was a description of an experiment done in Germany in 2007. They took a group of boys aged 12 to 14 and had them spend an hour after they'd finished their homework either watching a movie on TV, such as Harry Potter or Star Wars, or playing a video game. Each night, they did this for 1 hour, alternating between TV one night and the video game the next night. Then they measured their sleep patterns and how well they'd remembered the material they'd covered in their homework. Remarkably, they found that playing video games led to a markedly lower sleep quality than watching TV, and a significant decline in their ability to remember vocabulary words that they'd memorized the night before. It could be that the learning was damaged by the poor sleep, but it could also be that the playing of the video game kept the brain active and prevented the boys' brains from processing what they'd learned. So what can we do about all this? Well, we're hardly going to throw our computers away. In the next podcast, I'll address this question.
Copyright 2010, Daniel Jackson. Music copyright 2010, Chris Bremer from pianosociety.com.